Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/RobWolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cat's worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Hi, folks. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited for our guest today. Our guest is a world-renowned, best-selling author. She has produced some of my favorite written works in behavior change and happiness and well-being. Her name is Gretchen Rubin. She is the author of The Happiness Project. I'm sure that everyone has heard of that book, and you will soon hear about her latest book, Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives. Gretchen, how are you doing?
I'm so happy to be talking to you today.
I'm just giddy. Like, I literally have dancing feet right now. I've been such a big fan of yours for a very, very long time. So I think that this is going to be, I have a good friend. His name is Dan John. How he ended up with two first names for both first and last name, I have no idea. But he always makes the point that when you do something, try to make it benefit you, if not anyone else. And so I'm really looking at this, trying to benefit me and figure out how I change some habits in my life. But Gretchen, you have a really interesting, eclectic background. Could you give folks a little bit of your history?
Yeah, well, I started out in law. I, you know, went to law school and sort of did that all the way. I was editor-in-chief of the Law Review at Yale Law School. And I went on to clerk for Sandra Day O'Connor. And so I was, you know, really, you know, so heavily into law. But then when I was clerking for Justice O'Connor, I began to realize that actually I wanted to be a writer. And that was when I had the seeds for my first book. The thought is started to think about what that would be. And so eventually switched to being a writer. So now I'm a full-time writer.
Now, I've got to ask, and this is maybe a weird thing, but how did the practice of law and being around law at literally the highest levels in the world, how did that sow a seed for writing the book called The Happiness Project?
Well, I think the thing about law is that it really teaches you to make an argument. It really teaches you to think about, well, what would somebody, if I say this, what would somebody say? Or how would they say that what I'm saying is wrong? And so I think that it really influenced my writing and like just the clarity of it, of the argument, of understanding, like, how do I take somebody from this is what I'm arguing and this is how I convince you. But also it kind of made a negative because I read so much stuff that was so hard to read and was so, I thought, unnecessarily obscure that I just vowed. I was like Scarlett O'Hara, you know, as God is my witness, I'm going to write as clear as I possibly can for the rest of my life. And so when I'm writing, I just edit for clarity. Because I spent so much time reading stuff that wasn't clear, I became just determined to write in as clear and succinct a manner as possible.
Well, and you know, obviously that's been a huge part of your success and the reach that you've had, because there is such clarity in your writing. But I'm curious, you know, just on the topic of happiness, like, where was the seed crystal for that, particularly within the realm of law?
Well, actually, the Happiness Project was like my fifth book.
Okay.
So when I switched from law to writing, I was working on a book called Power, Money, Fame, Sex, a user's guide. And I got the idea for that because I was out for a walk during my lunch hour. I was clerking on the Supreme Court. So I was outside. I was staring up at the Capitol Dome against the blue sky. And I thought to myself, well, if I were going to write a book that would be interesting to me and that would be interesting to everybody else in the world, what would I write about? And I thought, well, power, money, fame, sex. And it hit me in a flash. Power, money, fame, sex. Like, this was a unit and I had to investigate it. So I went out and started doing massive amounts of research. And that book might sound very different from The Happiness Project or Better Than Before. Or I also wrote a biography of Winston Churchill. They might seem very different from each other to other people, but really my subject is human nature. Who are we? Why do we do the things that we do? And so every book that I've written has been to tackle human nature from a different way. So to me, they seem all very related to each other, even though I understand that if you look at them from the outside, they really look like this like crazy mishmash of topics.
No, it totally makes sense. And if I were to do a rewrite on power, money, fame, sex, I would just add nachos at the end of that. And then, but at least increase sales by a factor of 100. So, when you are considering human nature, like what kind of epistemological framework are you tackling that with? Like I tend, before we started recording, I mentioned that, even though I'm a coach and I guess theoretically kind of a health educator and whatnot, I tend to look at this a lot from an evolutionary biology perspective. I'm only now starting to really get in and do some reading on the nuts and bolts mechanistic elements of behavior change. But what's been your kind of driving epistemology for understanding human behavior?
Well, I really try to grab from every source that I can. So I read a lot of the science. I also am a big believer in the genetic roots of behavior, which I think are often underplayed. What I try to bring to the table is just observation, not to see things that no one else has seen or to get really deep into the science, but just to see what's happening in everyday, what's happening, what are the people all around us doing? What are the patterns of behavior that are quite obvious once somebody shines a spotlight on it, And so I'm kind of a street scientist, where a lot of times I think my biggest insights come from just a casual conversation with somebody, or often I'll notice a strange pattern where I'll think, well, this doesn't really make sense to me, but what one person after another is telling me that they've had the same experience. And so there must be some deeper pattern of human behavior involved, or else all these people wouldn't be experiencing the same challenge, or they wouldn't be saying the same remark kind of to an uncanny degree. And when I was thinking about habits for Better Than Before, many times what I saw was I would just think, well, there's some pattern that I don't really understand, and yet there must be some explanation for it, because why are so many people experiencing the same thing? And so I tried it, but I'm reading everything from the science to, memoirs to weird stuff like the design of kindergarten rooms, because, guess who thinks a lot about habits and how to shape people's behavior? It's people who are like in charge of little kids. Monastic governance. Like, I really try to cast a wide net. And that's part of what I love about what I do, is that it's kind of an excuse for me to read all this stuff that fascinates me, and then to try to distill it into something that can make sense to people who don't want to go out and read all that stuff. Well, I'll read it for you and kind of put it in some kind of framework so it's easier to understand.
No, I love that. And, we're in such an interesting time because we have so much information available.
Yes.
And the different sub-disciplines in any area, whether it's history or science or what have you, they become insular just based off of nomenclature, shorthand. When you get into, like, I haven't stayed on top of genetics in a while. And so if I start reading a paper that's interesting to me on genetics, I spend 45 minutes to an hour just getting reacquainted with, okay, this is the abbreviation for this gene, and that's the abbreviation for that gene. And so synthesis is a really challenging process now, because on the one hand, we see these big kind of macro patterns, but then to have some credibility, you've kind of got to auger in and get to some sort of fundamental, controlled scientific kind of thing, so that you can bridge that gap from the macro level to a more micro analyzed level. Do you see a challenge or some pushback from academics in that regard? Because they'll say, well, you know, this is a great theory, but there's no randomized controlled trial on this. You know, we see it again and again. It's kind of, you know, there's not really a randomized controlled trial on, you know, put a gun to your head, pull the trigger. If it's loaded, you're probably going to die. You know, I mean, we don't need, you have very potent statistical significance on just one episode of that. But how is this received in an academic setting?
Well, you know, it's funny because there's things that you can put, you know, you can test in a laboratory with a bunch of undergraduates eating marshmallows. And then there's some things that you miss. And I think that it's interesting for academics to see how you could look at it from a different way. Or even someone like Samuel Johnson, who's one of my favorite writers, and I feel like shows such a deep insight of human nature that often, you know, somebody will write a gigantic science paper and then somehow I'll be reminded of a Samuel Johnson quotation who summed it up in a single sentence. So I think there's all different kinds of ways. And you're right, like the more you get within your discipline and the more specialized becomes your vocabulary, in a way you can go deeper, but then in a way you also blind yourself to certain other ways of thinking. So I think it's helpful to try to approach these things in a lot of different ways and to see that there's a lot of there's many ways to understand the truth about human nature or to understand patterns. And so I really try to look at as many things as possible. You know, it's interesting to me to talk about scientists who study habits in labs, but it's also interesting for me to talk about trainers who work with people in gyms because they have a different view of people because they're actually working with an actual person. And then in an academic setting, then they have a different view too, because they're looking at it in a very different way. So, I mean, you know, if, as a writer myself, what I'm trying to do is really just help people understand themselves better. And so anything I can do that can shine a spotlight on people where they feel like, oh, wow, now I understand a pattern in my behavior, or oh, now I understand what I need to do differently. This is going to allow me to succeed. Or this is why I understand why I failed in the past. Aha, I see this missing element. You know, that's what I'm going for.
I love that. And, you know, in your book, you make an early point that the real secret to habit change is that you must know yourself.
Yes.
And how you have a really interesting process for helping people to learn, you know, who they are and how they function and whatnot. Again, you know, I tend to couch a lot of this stuff from like an evolutionary biology perspective. You know, if somebody's trying to affect behavior change with food, kind of understanding that we're wired up to be as lazy as possible and get as much food as possible while being lazy, and that, you know, that worked really well in the past and it maybe doesn't work so well now. But, you know, what's the process that you go through to help people understand, you know, who are they, so that they can then understand what their situation is now, and then if they choose to make a decision to do something different?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that one of the challenges with happiness is there's a lot of expert advice, and people say to you, do it first thing in the morning, or do it for 30 days, or start small, or give yourself a cheat day once a week. And the problem is those strategies work very well for some people sometimes, but they don't work for everybody all the time, which is obvious from just looking around you. And so what I found is there are actually 21 different strategies that people use to make or break their habits. And it's the same strategies to make or break. That doesn't matter. And the 21 can sound like, oh my gosh, that's such a gigantic number. It's overwhelming, but it's actually good because what it means is there's many from which to choose. Because for any individual, some of these are not going to appeal. Some aren't going to work. Some work very well for some people and they don't work at all for other people. Some aren't available to us at all times. They might be available sometimes, but not at others. Some are kind of not even within our control. But what you have to do when you're thinking about the 21 strategies is to start, as you say, with yourself. What kind of person are you? What are your values? What do you like? Because then you can set yourself up to succeed. And I mean, I think often night people and morning people, I mean, this is a big distinction. There truly are morning people and night people. You know, I used to, as a morning person, I used to think if people woke up earlier, if they went to bed earlier, they would wake up earlier and then they would be morning people. No, it's actually a genetically hardwired thing. People are morning people. Some people are real true night people. So if you're a night person, is it going to work for you to get up early and go for a run? Probably not. That's not the kind of thing that's going to work for you because you're a night person. And so what I try to do is to lay out a bunch of different ways for people to understand, well, how they might be like certain people and how they might be different. because you can't just say like, oh, well, this habit worked for Steve Jobs, or this habit worked for Ben Franklin, or this habit worked for my sister-in-law. Because maybe it'll work for you, but maybe not. You got to think about, well, what kind of person are you? And so I really try to, both in the strategy of the four tendencies, which divides all people into four categories, because I love to divide people into categories, or the strategy of distinctions, where I go through a lot of different distinctions. It's to help people see like, oh, I'm this kind of person, so this kind of thing is going to work for me. Or, oh, I see why I set that up in a way that's not going to be, it's not going to appeal to me over the long term.
No, it's fantastic. And, you know, I've always been interested in things like Myers-Briggs personality types and things like that. And it's really provided a lot of insight for me. And, you know, one of the challenges, particularly being in kind of the food realm, is that people really want black and white answers. Yeah. Low carb, high carb, done, you know, and over the, and, you know, I've got to say, when I had a more black or white perspective on things, my job was much easier. And as I've learned over time that there's actually almost infinite shades of gray, it frustrates my readership. You're in constant battles with people because, you know, you have these kind of all or nothing statements thrown out there. One thing that I encounter a lot is within mainstream dietetics, there's this thought that no food groups should be off limits, that everything is equally good. You just need to limit portion sizes.
Yeah.
And that has failed horrifically. But the riposte from kind of this mainstream kind of perspective is that categorizing any type of food in any type of a negative fashion is orthorexia, and it develops eating disorders. And what are your thoughts on that? I have some very deep-seated emotional thoughts on it, but what do you think about that?
Well, this touches on what I call the strategy of abstaining. And the strategy of abstaining is a strategy that works extremely well for some people and doesn't work at all for other people. And so the strategy of abstaining is just the observation, which I've noticed about myself, I'm an abstainer, that for some people, it's easier to have nothing. That once they've decided that something's off limits, when they take it off the table, they're fine. But if they start, it's kind of all or nothing. Like, I can have no Thin Mints, and or I can have 10 Thin Mints, but I can't have 2 Thin Mints. Kind of once I get started, I can't stop. I've never left an ice cream sundae half finished in my life. That's an abstainer. Now, moderators, by contrast, do better when they can have something a little bit, or sometimes. They get kind of panicky and rebellious if they're told they can never have something. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, if they know they can have something, they don't even want it. And when I understood this distinction, it made something clear to me that it always puzzled me as an abstainer, which is the people who keep like a bar of fine chocolate squirreled away somewhere, and once a day they have one square of fine chocolate, and that's all they want. But as an abstainer, I'm like, the whole day would be now, later, 2, 3, how many is enough? I would just be preoccupied with eating. I would eat the whole candy bar in one day. I would not eat square by square. But the thing is, there's no right way or wrong way. And for some people, abstaining is easier. And often, you know, moderators will say to me as an abstainer, you're too rigid. You need to learn not to be so harsh on yourself. If you give something up altogether, you're going to fall off the wagon. You're going to binge. And that's just not my experience. For me, abstaining is easier. And I've heard from so many people, because the book just came out, but I've been writing about this on my blog at GretchenRubin.com for a long time. And so many people have said to me, I always thought I had to try to be moderate and I couldn't be, but now I realize I can just abstain. And abstaining is easier. It sounds harder, but it's actually easier. And once I just, you know, like my sister had to give up French fries. That was her kryptonite. So with a strong temptation, for some people, it's easier to give it up altogether. But for some people, that doesn't work. For some people, it's better to be moderate. And I think what happens is that there's a lot of conflict because both people feel like they're doing it right. Both people can't really succeed using the other way. And yet they keep trying to convince each other. You know, I say to moderators, like, well, why don't you just go cold turkey? Or why can't you stick to your own rules? And moderators say to me, like, you're not being healthy. Like, you're too harsh on yourself. But for me, it's just easier to have no sugar is so easy. To have a little sugar, then I have to be thinking about it all the time. And it's just boring. These are strategies that it's really very different. And here you see like the roots of a lot of marital conflict. Somebody comes home with ice cream and the other, one person says, oh my gosh, why'd you buy ice cream? You know, I'm going to eat the whole thing. And the other person says, oh, you know, you need to learn to manage yourself better. Just have a little bit every night. And the other person's like, no, I can't. And it's like, it's an abstainer moderator. There's no right way or wrong way. It's just whatever works for you.
Why is it so hard? And I'm, you know, we're getting ready to crack open this huge risk assessment program. We did this paleo diet risk assessment program with a bunch of police and firefighters. Saved the city of Reno $22 million. We're getting ready to scale this thing up. And, you know, we're doing the best that we can. And we're going to be consulting with you extensively, by the way, whether you not to want to or not. But, you know, why is it so hard on kind of a national health level? Why is it so hard to have a meme or an articulation that some people will benefit from abstinence, some people will benefit from a more moderate approach? Why is it that, why is the meme one out, you know, and I'm kind of clearly kind of food oriented here. Why is the meme one out that, you know, Twinkies are equal to apples to everybody? We don't consider the hyperpalatability of food. We don't consider any evolutionary biology. Why is that meme one?
I think that there's just this desire for the one magic, like a magic one size fits all solution that, like, here's the answer, you know, and also, and not wanting to say, well, some people are some way and some people are another way. I think it's just that constant pressure to have the answer that's true for everyone, even though we know that it doesn't work, because clearly if it did work, we'd all, these things wouldn't be a factor. You know, and eating is complicated. There's so many things that are swirling around it, which is, again, why with the 21 strategies, I think it's important, because there's a lot of different things going on. There's how other people are affecting you. It's how convenient is it to get those foods. It's, you know, are you rewarding yourself with food in a way that's undermining your habits? Are you constantly generating loopholes that are letting you off the hook? Cause you're like, oh, sure. I'm keeping my good habits all the time, except for this one time, because you only live once and it's my birthday and I'm on vacation and I was so good yesterday, or I'm going to be so good tomorrow. You know, there's all these things, there's all these ways to tackle it, because it's complicated. There isn't an easy, just magic answer, that's going to work for everybody.
Damn it, Gretchen. Wait, what good is your book then if there's not a single magic answer?
Right.
This isn't getting me anywhere.
It's good because I think people get discouraged because they've tried something and they failed maybe multiple times. And what I feel like is this is good. It's encouraging to people because they say, like, well, you know, I've tried this before and it hasn't worked, but here's all these other things that I haven't tried. And if I try a couple of them all at the same time, I think people start to see how they can tackle it, you know, in a way that's realistic and actually manageable.
Nice, nice. Okay, so I want you to ruthlessly grade me on the way that I've been presenting some material. So when I do my greasy used car salesman pitch about this paleo thing, in the back of my head, trying to get people to generally eat better, I think a lot of folks have some food intolerances that are hard to ferret out until we've basically done an elimination diet. And so what I you know, try to get folks to do is go 30 days, no grains, no legumes, no dairy. Try to stick that to that as best you can. At the end of 30 days, reintroduce, see how you do, take the cost benefit, you know, kind of story at the end. My thought being that hopefully it's short enough that those people that, you know, that aren't the abstainers, it's not so long that it blows them out of the water, but then, you know, they get enough benefit that then at the end of that whole process, when they reintroduce these foods, say, like, if they have some gluten reactivity or something, they're kind of like, wow, okay, I really get it now. And now it's worth altering this. Like, you know, how am I doing with that? And how could I improve that message?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, the Four Tendencies framework is a framework about how people change habits. And one thing is that, I mean, 30 days is a short enough time that maybe people can stick to it because they're kind of doing a blast start. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't feel like it's a permanent habit change. It feels like it's a temporary thing that they're sort of experimenting with in kind of a fun way. Like, it's fun to kind of almost to deny ourselves of things can be, it's kind of exciting and interesting. I mean, one thing is that for many people, external accountability is crucial. And so if you have people who are having trouble sticking to it, you might want to think about helping people to create forms of external accountability, whether that's kind of groups or you're going to send them emails or whatever, so that they have a feeling of being supervised. Because for a lot of people, if it's just them being accountable to themselves, it's very hard for them to stick to it. But if they have a sense that somebody else, or maybe they're going to be a role model for someone else, like you want to say to them, like, don't you want to model good eating for somebody else? Or do you want to show somebody else that you can how to stick to a commitment? Because for a lot of people, it turns out external accountability is key. Those are the obligers in my framework. Obligers, real, and then questioners. Most people are either obligers or questioners. Questioners need justification, rationale. They're the ones that need a lot of information. Like, they're not going to do it unless they really believe in this system. So you kind of have to load them up with information, because they're going to be more hungry for. Other people maybe are going to accept it pretty. You know, they'll mm-hmm. kind of go along, but then some people they're like, I want data, I need information. Why am I listening to you? Why am I doing it this way? Is this the best way? Why did you pick 30? Why did you pick these things? For them, that's what's really important.
Would you say that maybe about 50% of the population is obligers, and then maybe about 25% of the population are questioners but able to be swayed? I'm asking a super leading question here, but what are your thoughts on kind of the numerical breakdown there?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's clear that rebel is a tiny, tiny category, and that upholder, so rebels are people who resist outer and inner expectations. Upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations, and I'm an upholder. And boy, many things in life were clearer to me when I realized that very few people are upholders. So these are the two extreme personalities, I would say, and they are very small. Almost everybody is a questioner or an obliger. And I think you're right that obliger is slightly larger, but questioner is also a very large category of people.
Interesting.
But I do think obliger is the biggest cut, is the biggest tendency. And they also have the tendency to get along the best. They're like the type O, also mm-hmm. tendencies, which makes sense since they're obligers. They sort of tend to get along with all the other tendencies.
So they're the ones that keep the rest of us from killing one another. They're like a social buffering system.
Well, they're the rock of the world. Yeah, right. Definitely.
It's interesting because in the gym and in traveling, I figured out this kind of back of the envelope thing that, you know, about 50% of people, if you hit them with this idea of like an anti-inflammatory diet, sleep a little more, do some exercise, are like, cool, sign me up. Easy sell, no problem. Let's check this out. We'll do blood work before, do blood work afterwards. This will be a cool experiment. About out of the remaining 50% of the population, about 25% of those people, I had to beg, cajole, threaten, educate, and eventually when those people broke, they became like jihadis on this stuff. Like, you almost had to hose them down. They were so rabid in their adherence, even though it was a shit fight of a battle to get them into it. Once you finally got them sold, it was kind of crazy. And then there was this final 15 to 20% that I could set myself on fire, I could set them on fire, and it wasn't going to change a thing. So I was just kind of curious what you had seen as far as, you know, some kind of breakdowns there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and on my site, I have a quiz if people want to take an online quiz to find out what their tendency is, on GretchenRubin.com. So that, you know, it leads you through a series of questions that then tells you. And my framework is all about how you respond to an expectation. And, you know, you're working with a very specific kind of change. So, but that's interesting that, what you found when you were trying to convince people to do it.
Yeah, and you know, that's already existing within a selection bias that these people have walked through the door of a gym. You know, like when I talk to the folks that I know that are primary care docs, like, they just have a whole other world to deal with. You know, like, there's no selection bias there. The only people who are maybe more cranky than seeing their doctor are people that need to see a mechanic. You know, they just, it's horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the loophole spotting, as a client that I have to work with, the loophole spotter was someone that I wanted to kill and bury in a shallow grave. Why do those people get my goat so much? And, you know, I did not get a chance to do my four tendencies quiz yet, and it would be interesting to know that, and maybe that's why the loophole spotter gets my goat. But why do those people get in my kitchen so bad and just spin me out?
You mean the people who generate loopholes?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, the strategy of loophole spotting is to be on the lookout for these loopholes, because we are like these amazing advocates for ourselves. You know, Yeah, sure. Of course, I'm totally committed to keeping my good habit, except in this one instance right now, at the spur of the moment, I just realized there's a loophole. And there's 10 categories of loopholes. And I have to say, of all the strategies that I love all my strategies, but this was this is the funniest strategy. And I loved working on this chapter because I just love writing down all the crazy, hilarious, imaginative loopholes that people, and I had to go through and cut out like 90% because the book, it was ridiculous how many great I had. And most of us have a favorite loophole. Like some of the more popular ones are, well, they're all popular. Like the tomorrow loophole. Well, it doesn't matter what I'm doing today because tomorrow I'm going to be tomorrow I'm starting my diet. So it doesn't matter what I do today. Or the fake self-actualization loophole, which is you only live once. I want to accept myself just as I am. I have to act now or miss out forever. Yeah. But sometimes to be happier, healthier, more productive, we sometimes have to deny ourselves something in the present or ask more of ourselves. There's the concern for others loopholes. Well, other people are going to feel uncomfortable if I don't have a drink at this business dinner, or if I don't have a piece of birthday cake, my host's feelings are going to be hurt. There's the, oh my gosh, one of the best loopholes, because it works in every situation, is the one coin loophole, which gets its name from an ancient teaching story, which says, would you say that one coin makes a man rich? No, you would not. But if you gave a man, what if you give a man one coin? What if you gave a man another coin? What if you give him another coin? At some point, you have to say that a man has become rich because one coin made him so. And the one coin loophole we can do, because it's like, well, what difference does one cupcake make? What difference does it make if I had, what's a couple beers? Why should I go to the library today? My thesis isn't due for 2 years. Why should I wear a helmet today? What are the chances I'm going to get in an accident today? Any one time we do anything, it's true. It's inconsequential. Like, what's one thing? But the only way we have good habits is one thing after one thing after one thing. And so people often toggle back and forth between, oh, yeah, I'm totally committed to doing this, but why bother to do it today? Today doesn't matter. And so, and then, oh, I mean, my favorite loophole probably is false choice. Oh, you know, I'm too busy writing to make those appointments. Really? Is that really the choice that you have? Moral licensing. I've been so good. I deserve to have.
crushing me.
Planning to fail. Like, you know how here I am in my favorite bakery. Who could resist? And you're like, why are you standing in the middle of your favorite bakery? It's 10 blocks from your house. Like, how did that happen? Somehow you found yourself there. So anyway, the loopholes are hilarious. And I think for many people, they run through our minds almost like we're not even conscious that we're invoking them because they're so familiar and we're so good at generating them. And just by pointing them out, a lot of times people are like, oh, wow, you know, questionable assumption. The label says it's healthy, but is it really healthy? Should I be questioning that assumption? Just seeing the loopholes spelled out then helps people be on their guard. So the next time they're getting ready to pull in a loophole to break a good habit, they say, wait a minute, let me step back here. Maybe I don't want to fall for it this time.
Oh, man, I need you full time in my life. you need to be my buffer between me and the rest of my reality, because you've got this stuff wired. This is maybe a little, this might be difficult to answer, but where does the delineation occur between, quote, simple behavior change and altering addiction? What's that demarcation?
Well, you know, in my book, I don't talk about addictions, compulsions, nervous habits, or habits of mind. But clearly, the line between habit and addiction is very fluid. And, you know, some people, the idea of addiction is itself controversial. You know, and I think sometimes the question is somebody addicted to something that's otherwise good? Are you addicted to exercise? Are you, you know, and there the question is, well, is it enriching your life and making your life larger, or is it making your life smaller and more cramped and feel confined? So one person's exercise addiction, you know, I have a friend who people say, oh, she's addicted to exercise. But if you ask her, she's like, it's amazing. I've made all these friends. I'm constantly going to new places. I love training. Like, for her, it's making her life bigger. And so I wouldn't call that an addiction. But then for some people, if it's like, oh, you know, it's haunting me. I can't, it's interfering with my relationships. It's interfering with my responsibilities. I feel frantic if I can't do it. Well, then it's starting to edge into being a negative behavior. And then we also use it colloquially to just mean something that we feel out of control. You know, Are you addicted to Candy Crush? Are you addicted to sugar? Are you addicted to Game of Thrones? Are you addicted to video games? I mean, the question of whether something is truly an addiction, I think the question is this a habit that's not making me happier, healthier, or more productive? Is this a habit that I want to get in? I'm feeling a loss of control of myself. I feel like I'm not a master of the life that I want to live. And so therefore I want to see if I can change that habit. To me, it's less important about arriving at final definitions and more important to say, well, how can I have the life that I want to have? And how can I change my behavior so that my life reflects my values, my interests, my nature, in a way that makes me feel good and doesn't make me feel you don't want the things that are supposed to make you feel better make you feel worse. And a lot of times that's what happens with negative habits. They start because we like them, but then they become poison.
That's a beautiful way to look at it. I was actually jotting down some notes. Is what you're doing opening the aperture of your life or constricting it? And
yes.
And are you enriched or receiving pain from that change?
Yes.
That is just beautiful. I really like that. What do you see as some of the really hot topic changes that people are wrestling with today? I mean, food seems like a biggie. Exercise seems like a biggie. Enough sleep, not getting sucked under the riptide of social media. Like what do you, and how do those interact? Like I'm curious, how does social media cracking, crack core of social media affect lack of exercise and food? Yeah. And stuff like that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've identified like the essential seven, which seem to be that just about every habit that people want falls into seven categories, many of which you touched on. One is to eat and drink more healthfully, exercise regularly, save, spend, and earn wisely, rest, relax, and enjoy. That's things like turn off your cell phone and stop watching TV in bed. Accomplish more, stop procrastinating. So those are habits related to getting stuff done. Simplify, clear, clean, and organize. That's about your surroundings. And then finally, engage more deeply in relationships, whether that's with other people, with God, with the world, the sense of like wanting to deepen engagement and using habits as a way, as something that can either help you or interfere. And then in just talking to people, I mean, the things you mentioned absolutely are come up all the time. Interesting, a lot of people want to drink less. They don't want to give up drinking. It's not like they have a problem with alcohol, but they just feel like they're more on their game if they would drink less.
Mm-hmm.
So they want the fun of drinking, but not the downside. And sometimes, sometimes it's hard to do something less than to not do it at all. So that's something to manage. And one thing I think that's surprising to people is that sometimes it's just as hard to form a habit of something that you love to do as something that you don't love to do. Like you think, well, I get why it's hard to make myself cook if I don't like cooking, but what if I love to cook? Why can't I form a habit? And what I see is that the same strategies often have to be used because for some people, sometimes like me, the fact that I enjoy something almost makes me put it lower down on the list because I'm very focused on crossing the things I don't like to do off first. And so sometimes the things that are fun get shoved to the side. Well, that's not a good recipe for a happy life. So I have to make sure that I have habits for the things that I love to do, just as for the things that maybe don't come as easily to me.
Let me see if I got that correctly. And I'm drawing some old neuro-linguistic programming stuff where they would say, almost anybody has achieved success at something. So
yeah.
Figure out the psychological state, the tendencies that allowed you to achieve a 400-pound body weight or, whatever it is, and then apply those strategies to these other areas. But if I understood you correctly, that's not necessarily the case, right?
Well, I do think that one really helpful thing to do is to look back at your past and say, well, have I succeeded at this at another time? Because if I succeeded at it in the past, maybe there's something that I'm not understanding that I could be doing now that would make it easier. So take cooking, for instance. I spoke to somebody who was like, oh, I hate to cook. But then when she thought about it, she realized that, well, in her past, there was a time where she did cook a lot. And it turned out that when she thought about it, what she didn't like was food shopping. She hated to go to the grocery store. It wasn't the cooking. And when she'd cooked in the past, it's because she was living in a group house and she had a roommate who liked to go grocery shopping and so who bought all the ingredients. And so sometimes it's like understanding what the underlying patterns are, or like my, you know, A friend of mine who, you know, said, well, when I was on the track team in high school, I never missed track practice, but I can't go running now. When she had a team and a coach that held her accountable, she had no trouble, but now she can't because she didn't have that external accountability. So, okay, so build that in. So sometimes if you look at your past, because you're right, most people have things where they have succeeded, that can have clues as to like what is going to help you succeed now. One thing is, I don't really look at emotional states. I don't think I use the word motivation one time in the book. Mm-hmm. And I never think about things like self-esteem or setting priorities, like intellectually or like emotional eating or any of that, because I feel like, and I never talk about things like neuroplasticity or what's happening in your brain, because these are things that it's very hard to get our minds around. We can't really affect that. Behavior we can affect. Behavior is concrete. So if you focus on your behavior, then your mind will follow. And so I'm like, don't worry about motivating yourself to do something. Worry about what are you going to do? And then you can do something. You can decide to do something and figure out ways to help you stick to that decision and make that behavior happen. That just seems more like an easier, more straightforward course to me than trying to work on your inner emotional states, which to me is very hard to do.
I completely agree. You know, and it's interesting. If you do circle it back around into some neuroplasticity and motor programming and whatnot, it seems more and more clear that our inner state, even our brain circuitry, is more of a reflection of how we interface with the environment, and that plasticity changes with the way that we interface with the environment. And so instead of doing a lot of inner child, unique snowflake searching, if we just figure out some way by hook or by crook to simply do things differently, then we're kind of off and running.
And it's a lot easier.
Again, you maybe answered this already because it maybe brushes into the addiction kind of story. But what about trying to change habits related to dysfunctional relationships? Like, because people will do a lot of like psychoanalysis and all that type of stuff. But I mean, where does the, discovering who you are and then, affecting change in that regard, is it kind of the same process? Doesn't matter if it's cupcakes or dysfunctional people.
Well, what's the habit?
Let's say you tend to get into abusive, kind of codependent relationships and lose yourself in that process, and you just do it again.
To me, I wouldn't call that a habit. Okay. That's maybe a pattern of behavior that you're doing, but I wouldn't really call that a habit.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Now, I do think looking at the four tendencies, which again, whether you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, a rebel, I think a lot of times you can understand why you're having any of the distinctions, you understand why you're having conflict with people because you just see the world in a very different way. So for instance, rebels, we talked about rebels. So rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. If you tell them to do, if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to do the opposite. And it has nothing to do with you. It's not that they hate you or they're rejecting you. It's like they don't want anybody to tell them what to do. They don't even want to tell themselves what to do. So if you're married to a rebel and you say to your rebel, hey, it's your turn to take out the trash, the rebel's probably going to be like, well, you know what? I was going to, but now that you told me to, I'm not going to. Because you can't tell me what to do. You can't make me. And that's just their nature. And so I've talked to a lot of people who are in relationships with rebels, and you really have to learn how to work with that personality type or not. I mean, you kind of, it's like, it's there. And same thing with obligers. Like maybe, as an upholder, I'm frustrated sometimes with obligers because I'm like, why don't you just do the thing? You keep saying you want to do something. Why don't you just do it? But an obliger needs external accountability. And so if you're married to an obliger, or you manage an obliger, or you're working on a team with an obliger, and you're frustrated with them not meeting their inner expectations, well, the thing is to figure out how can you help them create external accountability for the things that they want to succeed at. So, and I think that the more that you understand that how people see the world in a different way, it's not that anybody's right or wrong, but that we all come to it from a different perspective. And so we need to figure out how we can all get to where we want to go. I mean, a thing that comes up a lot in work is with work pace. Some people are marathoners. They like to work steadily, well in advance. They don't like to be up against a deadline. They feel like doing a little bit over a long period unleashes their creativity and their productivity. But sprinters, on by contrast, they love to be up against the deadline. They like the adrenaline of the crunch. They feel like that's what creates the most creativity and productivity. And if they start too early, they kind of burn out, lose interest. Well, there's no right way or wrong way. And you can see in different circumstances, these different work styles could be beneficial. But if you've got a team where people have different work styles, they might keep telling each other, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. Well, it's not that one person's right or one person's wrong, but they have different styles. They have different habits of work. And that's something to be thinking about. And I think sometimes just having vocabulary, just saying like, I'm an abstainer and you're a moderator, or, you know, it's not that these labels should constrain us and make us feel like we're locked into an identity, but just by giving us an easy shorthand to talk about what's true for us, how we see the world, how we function best, then sometimes we can avoid conflict, you know, and have more insight into other people and how their perspective is just different. And also maybe frame habits in a way that it's going to be more compelling to them, because it's more reflecting of the way they see the world.
Oh, my wife is definitely a sprinter. She will fiddle and fart and procrastinate, and then it's the 12th hour or, you know, 11th hour, 59 minutes, and then she's on this thing. And she always does a great job, but I have to, like, crawl under the house and can't even watch this process, you know? And so, like, I have a talk coming up in Austin on the 23rd of this month of April, and I've been working on this talk since the 23rd of last month, you know, and I'm almost done with it, and I'm going to have about a month buffer. But even then, like, even before I started working on the thing, I was waking up at 4 a.m, taking notes on it and stressed out. And it wasn't until I embarked on that process and I got my first big outline done where I was kind of like, okay, if I had to give this talk tomorrow, right, I could get something done. It wouldn't be my A work, but I could do it. But it was just going to consume me up until that last minute. Whereas Nikki, it would be in the back of her head and she'd, you know, kind of bebopping along. And then when, you know, it's time for all hell to break loose, then it does. And that's interesting. That is so interesting.
I just started a podcast with my sister called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. And I saw this because the minute we were sort of like starting it, I was like, we got to get it. We've got to get started. We've got to get everything. We got to get as many decisions made as possible. Like, we've got to get on top of this. And some people were like, well, we've got plenty of time. Like, we'll get to it, you know, when we need to. And I was just like, no, because as a marathoner, you're like, I see this checklist and I even if this deadline is far away, like, there's just a lot of things that I want to get through. I mean, fortunately for me, my sister is like, she's probably not as much of a marathoner as I am, but she's flexible. And so it worked for her, but I could imagine that for somebody else, they'd be like, why are we worrying about this now? We don't have to have it done for a month. But I'm like, come on, like, we need to get all these things locked down.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, my wife and I work together a lot. And so we've had to learn you know, it's almost like a transmission where, like, my gearing doesn't directly mesh with hers. And there needs to be a little bit of a lag with that stuff where I can get certain elements of my work done, pump it off to her. She can wait until the last minute. I have no anxiety about it getting done because I know that she will kill herself to get it done. But I also can't watch that process. Like, I just need to be out of the house somewhere while she's in that final sprint mode. But it's interesting. But we've only, you know, it was through really just kind of dumb luck that we figured out some coping strategies with that. Whereas if we had had some nomenclature and some understanding, like what you offer in the book, I think it would have been much easier. It's kind of like, oh, okay, well, I'm just wired this way, you're wired that way. It's completely cool. Like, we spent a couple of years of just like shit talking each other that we were both broken, you know, and neither one of us were. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, where, God, there's so many, I literally have like 50 other questions written down here, and I'm trying to whittle it down because we're sneaking up close on an hour. I'm interested on the pairing part. Like, how does that play into the, you know, you're sitting is the new smoking and pairing, like, how does that plug into this?
Well, the strategy of pairing is one that came so easily to me that I almost like didn't even notice it. And yet I found that it's super powerful for a lot of people. And that is, you take a habit of something that maybe you're not so enthusiastic about, and then you pair it with something that you really love, that you really want to do. And this is not a reward. It's not like, if I do this thing I don't want to do, then I will reward myself with this other thing. It's that they only go together. And one of the ways that this is most often used is for people who are like running on a treadmill or on a stationary bike or whatever, at the gym, will watch TV. So let's say you love reality TV. Can you watch reality TV if you're on the treadmill? Yes, you can. You're sick in bed and you can't go for a run because you're too sick. Can you watch reality TV? No, you can't, because those things only go together. Reality TV and running on the treadmill. It's not a reward. It's just that these two things are paired. And for many people, this, and again, I was mentioning my podcast, several people have said to me like, oh, one of the things I pair is podcasts and, you know, going for a walk or doing my weekly cleaning or walking the dog or something. Like, they pick something that they want to get themselves to do, and they pair it with something that they're really eager for. But you don't get to have it unless you have the other, unless the both parts of the pair come into being. You know, listen to like a really compelling audiobook. You know, you're going to be eager to get to the gym if that's when you get to listen to it. And so this is a really good way of making it the habit become easier and more pleasant, because there's something about it that you're really looking forward to.
Oh, I love it. And you know, funny enough, the weather's been pretty dodgy in Reno. We have a Schwinn Airdyne and a VersaClimber in my garage. I hate both of them with the fires of a thousand suns. But I put on Archer, the FX animated deal, which, and it makes it palatable. And I get a half hour, 45 minutes of it. And then my keister hurts too badly, even switching back and forth eventually. And then I'm done with it. But if I do that, and that's the only time I watch Archer, and it's funny I can't watch it when I'm just laying around. I can't watch it, you know, doing other things. The only time I get to watch it is during that time. And luckily, there's like seven seasons of it, and I'm only on season two. So, yeah.
Pairing.
Well, Gretchen, tell folks where they can track you down. Let folks know about your podcast, and also be sure to let them know. And we will have all of this in the show notes as well. But where they can do the Four Tendencies quiz.
All right. So on my site, GretchenRubin.com, I have a ton of information about habits. There's a quiz where you can take the quiz to find out your four tendencies. Like 130,000 people, I think, now have taken it. There's also a lot of resources. Like, if you want to start a group for people who are changing their habits together, kind of an accountability group, there's a starter kit for forming a group. There's a lot of, there's a checklist so that if you want to change a habit, you can go through the checklist of the 21 strategies and figure out everything you're going to do, and a bunch of discussion guides, a bunch of stuff like that. I started this podcast, which has been doing great. It's so exciting. We're having so much fun with it.
Awesome.
I do with my sister, Elizabeth Kraft, who's a TV writer in Los Angeles, and it's called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, and it's all about how to have a happier, healthier, more productive life, how to have better habits, how to think about the things that you could change in your life, the little manageable things that you can do in your everyday life to become happier. So that's on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, all that. So there's a lot of stuff online for people who want to connect, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I love to hear from readers. I love to hear what other people are thinking about habits, so I really encourage people to get in touch with me and to explore. And then, of course, there's the book, Better Than Before, which is where I lay out the 21 strategies, you know, for all to see and benefit from, I hope.
Well, I've gotten a ton out of it, and I've only gone through this thing once. Like, I will take a photo of this thing and show you how dog-eared and lined and like tabs in it. Like, this thing looks like it's been chewed up by a dog.
I love that. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Well, I know you think about all this stuff so much yourself. I'm thrilled to hear that you felt like it was useful to you, because I mean, this is stuff that you have thought about a lot.
You know, I've thought about it a lot, but I've got to say, I've been in a cultural or intellectual cul-de-sac where, you know, I'm really steeped in this kind of evolutionary biology story. And I think there's a lot of great stuff to learn from that. And I think it's a fantastic starting point. But where it's failed me and where I've failed the folks that follow me is I really you know, the actionable things to do, I've arrived at those by accident. And what you've done with Better Than Before, and particularly, I think, you know, some of the, you know, figuring out your four tendencies and stuff like that, you really provide a framework so that when we go to our tool bag, we have an understanding of a little bit better idea of, okay, given your tendencies, which set of tools are more likely to work for you instead of just slapping stuff against the wall and hoping that something right. comes out of that. Or, you know, which I think has been a tendency, the folks that gravitate towards my particular style and the things that I'm articulating, if it fits with what they're doing, then it works for them. And if it doesn't, then I fail them. And I think by looking at this stuff, I would have a much better tool bag to be able to refer people to. You know, if you understand where you are on these different spectrums, then we will be able to tackle this in a different way. And we can also, you know, just simple things like, hey, it's reasonable for you to completely exclude certain foods because, you know, it's going to be a trigger for you, and it's completely reasonable for your spouse to be a little bit moderate with that. And we need to figure out how one of you doesn't undermine the other one in that process vilify the other one. So, yeah, well, you did an amazing job with this. I'm just very excited. And I was so excited that you agreed to come on the podcast. I love your work.
Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate it. I feel like we could talk all day. Thank you so much.
Would you be game for maybe coming back on in about 6 months and we collect some questions and you do some Q&A?
Sure, absolutely. That would be terrific.
Okay, awesome. Well, folks, we've been talking with Gretchen Rubin. Her new book is Better Than Before. We will have all of that in the show notes. Gretchen, again, thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.